Hello everyone, welcome to Midnight Feast. This is the animal special, and I'm joined here by Bernadette Russell.
We're recording this at midnight after I Sit and Comfortably Animals, which we very much enjoyed, and we've got some great extra stories for you to listen to.
Yes, and to start with, we have a very special story by Katie Young, who's a regular with I Sit and Comfortably. She's getting a book published again in November. We're going to talk about that later on. Her new novel, but this is one of her short stories, and this is by Bernadette.
This is Mary by Katie Young. Charlie paced the floor of the Kingsport County Jail, wringing his cap in his hands. But I've known her since she was just 4 years old. My wife, Eddie, and I, we don't have any children of our own, I'm sorry to say, and Mary's about the closest thing to a daughter that I can imagine. She's gentle and she's kind, and I cannot understand the severity of her actions. She would not have done this unless she was provoked. The mayor stroked his moustache.
She killed a man. The townsfolk want justice, he said. She stamped on that poor guy's head till it burst like a rotten watermelon, and in front of the children, too.
Charlie's shoulders slumped, and his chin sank toward his chest. I know I saw. I shall never forget the sight as long as I live.
Nor I,
agreed the mayor, blanching. I could send her away, somewhere no one knows her or what she's done.
She's not sound of mind, Mr. Sparks,
the mayor said, slamming his hand on the desk.
She's a danger to all around her. She can't stay here either. News of that boy's death is spreading through Tennessee like wildfire. I heard whispers there's a mob forming, and they're coming for her. The people will see Mary die for what she did.
Charlie's ears still rang with the screams of women and children, and the chant which swelled with the crowd's anger. Kill her! Kill her! Kill her! He swallowed past the lump in his throat and nodded. I know what must be done, he said, a tremor in his voice. On the morning of the hanging, the circus train pulled slowly and solemnly into the town of Irwin. The dreary grey sky and incessant drizzle did little to deter the crowds. They gathered early to see if the troupe would perform an aperitif, a warm-up act prior to the main event. Charlie, his heart heavy with grief, acquiesced. He was, after all, a businessman. And with Mary, their star attraction, soon to be out of the picture, the rest of the travelling show had an arduous winter ahead of them. The acrobats tumbled. The sword swallower juggled knives and flaming batons before slipping them down his throat. The animals pranced for their ringmaster and leapt through hoops of fire. And while the finely tuned parts of the circus machine all snicked into place as they did every single day, not a soul among the performers or the audience was focused on the marvels happening inside the tent. Instead, they all imagined what murderous Mary would look like as she dangled and the life was choked from her bulky body. Mary waited outside in chains, shifting her weight nervously from side to side and shaking her head. Charlie knew she wouldn't fully comprehend the grisly fate that awaited her, but she had an inkling something was very wrong. And she was afraid. Charlie gazed deep into her dark, trusting eyes and brushed her face with his fingertips, and she leant into his touch. While he wanted nothing more than to unlock her shackles and run, the showman in him, the carny, rubbed his hands together in anticipatory glee. What a spectacle he'd give them all. What an unforgettable display. People would talk about this for years to come. The hanging of murderous Mary. But no sooner had the duplicitous thought scuttled darkly across his mind, he felt his gorge rise and he heaved and spat into the dirt. It was time. Many of the troop, unable or unwilling to watch the gruesome punishment meted, remained in the tent while Charlie and the others led Mary to the rail yard where the deed would be done. The two youngest members of their procession clung anxiously to her, one in front and one behind, as she lumbered towards the waiting horde. On their approach, an excited chatter filled the air, and as they drew closer, Charlie saw the yard was packed with spectators. There must have been 2,000 in the bloodthirsty crowd, many huddled atop boxcars and swarming over the engines, clamouring for a better view. And there it was, the derrick, reaching up into the silver sky, a makeshift noose swinging heavily from its arm. An eerie quiet descended as Mary saw her gallows. She looked to Charlie, and he started to weep, hoping the rain would disguise his tears. And a high-pitched shriek split the silence, and Charlie knew the game was up. 8 roustabouts grabbed Mary, dragging her away from the startled young'uns and chained her to the tracks. Another chain was thrown around her neck and fastened in place. The signal was given, and the winch screeched into life. The chain grew taut and tightened around Mary's throat. She kicked and struggled as her front legs left the ground. Panicked, trumpeting, and a sickening crunch ricocheted around the rail yard as Charlie realised with horror that Mary's back legs were still bound to the tracks. Her trunk thrashed around as her thick tendons stretched and tore.
"Sorry, boss," one of the carnies called as he rushed to release the limbs, raising his palms in supplication as he passed. "We ain't never had to hang no elephant before."
Very nice. Good old Katie. It's a really good story. One of our regular writers, Katie Young. And she has got a pub. She's got a novel out, hasn't she?
Yeah. Katie has written a dark fantasy novel called The Other Lamb. And that's due to be published by the Erato imprint of Musa Publishing autumn of this year. So very shortly, she's got a book launch coming out. She's got a great website, katieyoungauthor.wordpress.com. So check it out.
Yeah, she's a really good Katie. She's been a really good contributor to Are You Sitting Comfortably over the last 5 years. It's 5 years we've been doing this. Yeah. This is mad. Okay, so our next story is by David M. Morgan, and it's called A Grown Your Own Meerkats. George really, really wanted to have a meerkat, but Mum and Dad wouldn't let him. "Why?" asked George. "Because they live in the Kalahari Desert," said Mum.
"Because they're wild animals," said Dad. "And wild animals make me sneeze."
So that was that. Or so George thought. He sat on the floor and frowned. When George went to the park with Mum, as always busy on her mobile phone, he found a packet that must have come from a catalogue. It said, "Grow your own meerkats. 1. Put each little pup in a bowl of water. 2. Leave for 3 hours to soak. 3. Each little pup will grow to 10 times its size." Inside the packet, George found quite a few furry toy pups. There wouldn't be enough bowls. Then he had a really good idea. "I'll wait till Mum and Dad have gone to bed. And I put them all in the bath." It seemed ages before the lantern light was switched off. George tiptoed into the bathroom and ever so quietly filled the bath with warm water. He sprinkled the meerkat pups into the water and went back to bed. In the morning, he crept back into the bathroom. Slowly he opened the door. Meerkats! Not only were they much bigger, they were alive! 2 meerkats were tap dancing on the taps. 2 were ringing a rosin on the floor. Others were doing the backstroke in the bath. Splash, splash, splashing. "Shh," said George. "You're awake, Mum and Dad." A spotted meerkat and a dotted meerkat were playing catch with a rubber duck.
"Hello, George," said the spotted meerkat, standing straight up and staring at him. "Look, there are 12 of us."
And so there were. George counted. Suddenly, a loud sneeze from Mum and Dad's bedroom. The tap dancing meerkats sprang off the taps onto the ring of rosy meerkats, and they all fell down. They were so busy enjoying themselves, they didn't hear George asking them to stop. "George?" Mum called. "Where are you?" George thought quickly and led the meerkats out of the house and down the garden path and into the shed where they found Dad's lawnmower. "Let's mow the lawn!" they shouted.
The meerkats made the garden into a playground. They climbed on the empty flower pots. They chased one another through the flower beds. They rode on the lawnmower.
What's that noise? Asked Dad.
The lawnmower was going crazy, nearly as crazy as the meerkats. George couldn't help laughing, but he was worried. Then all of a sudden, the meerkats stopped, stood up straight, stared at each other, and began to shrink. They went back to being furry puppy toys. George picked them up and put them back into the packet. Just then Dad came out. He stared at the upturned mower.
What the?
He said. A piece of paper fluttered from the packet. It said, 1. Wet puppies will be lively for up to 3 hours. 2. If they dry out, you must wet them again or they will shrink and go to sleep.
Well, thought George, now I know what's what, I can play with my meerkats whenever I like.
He smiled at Dad.
I'll help you tidy the garden, he said.
And he did. That was David R. Morgan. I said David M. Morgan, first of all. I got the letters mixed up. That's what I'm like.
Mm. We've had a bit of a drink, let's be honest.
We've had a drink, yeah. But not that much of a drink. We're
no.
One.
We're not actually drunk.
No. And that was a lovely story. It's a really lovely story. And he's a great writer. He sent me about 6 stories, and all of them are great. We picked that one. Yeah, it's really great. Okay, so the next story, who's that by, Belinda?
This next story is called Duck Rabbit, and it's by Gareth Damien Martin. I'd just like to apologise now. He went out on the newsletter, is Gareth Alexander Martin. Alexander's his middle name, so silly me. So this is Duck Rabbit by Gareth Damien Martin. When I was a child, I had a favourite book, something I'd picked up from the trestle tables of a jumble sale. Its dog-eared pages and dull orange cover somehow caught my attention, and I dropped a handful of jingling pennies in the withered hands of a lilac-scented old lady and ran off, book in hand. It was a book of cheap tricks. Some were magic tricks to perform to friends and family, with diagrams of contorted hands crisscrossed with dotted lines. Others were thought puzzles, succinct and esoteric paragraphs that tied my mind in knots. Finally, there were optical illusions, faces that could be seen up or down, endless staircases and patterns that spun on the page. These were my favourite. Buried underneath a sheet with a torch, I would stare at the yellowing pages, drawn into this world of illusion by the flickering images that the lines formed. There was one illusion I would always return to. A hairy ball with 2 warped long rectangles that thrust out of one end with a small cleft at the other, sitting on a fat neck. In a small depression in the hairy ball was a black staring eye with a bright white highlight. Below the drawing were 2 lines of text. Duck, rabbit, look deeper. And below this, and then deeper. When I looked at the rectangles, the image would settle as a duck, its beak skewed open in a grimace. But as I looked back to the eye, the cleft would catch me and the rabbit appeared, its long ears tipped back and its eyes staring. I would drift my eyes back and forth across this image, from duck to rabbit, rabbit to duck. Almost all of the other puzzles in the book had a solution, and I was convinced I could find one here. With the only clue, those enigmatic lines of text, in mind, I began to look deeper. I thought perhaps if I could look deep enough, the image would settle, perhaps with duck, perhaps with rabbit. Some days I would think I had it, that it was settling, but as I drew back, the image would turn. I could look at the rectangles and see a duck's beak. I could stare at the cleft and see a rabbit's nose, but neither was a whole image. Instead, only 2 fragments, a beak or a nose, always with one lurking in a blind spot. It was not possible to look fully at the back of the duck's cloven head or the rabbit's sharp ears. I never showed the book to anyone, not even my parents. After so long staring at the image, I'd become fixed with fear. The thought entered my head that if someone else saw the image, they would smile and turn to me, hand on my shoulder, tell me definitively what it was. They would pronounce duck or rabbit or perhaps something else. hiding among the lines. I was afraid that this flickering problem, this unsettleable state, would be dismissed as a simple truth, that it would be no problem. But it was a problem. It was my problem. So I continued to stare at it late into the night, to stuff it under my pillow at the creak of a floorboard, and throughout the school day to draw first a duck, then a rabbit, and again in the margins of my book, forming a great procession that marched through all my other knowledge. The one unknowable thing. When my parents were killed in the fire, the book was the only thing I took with me, tightly gripping it as I looked out of the car window, watching my childhood home recede into darkness. I don't remember when I put aside my obsession with a duck rabbit. I imagine it must have been a slow slip, the obsessions of an adult life slowly replacing it, piece by piece. Even my interest in illusion seemed to falter, making way for a need to focus on the concrete parts of making a life for myself. A house, a job, a family. Yet it somehow remained, buried deep in my mind. I remember seeing a drawing by my young son, a fractured scrawl of scattered lines, and noticing that somehow it held two images. I stood there, facing the fridge, stepping side to side, watching as the lines formed two separate figures, one crouched and afraid, the other lashing out in anger. Fear and anger, fear and anger. The sound of my bare feet unsticking themselves from the kitchen floor, back and forth, over and over. The eye held something. When the duck was in possession of the image, the eye housed an anger, a malevolence. The duck's twisted beak always hungry. When the rabbit held possession, the eye filled with fear, his head tilted back in subjugation. How could the eye hold both of these binary images, both of these emotions? As I stared deep into the eye, I saw neither anger nor fear. And slowly I saw that it was looking neither left nor right, but outwards. Hidden beneath the duck and beneath the rabbit, hiding in their collective organic mass was that black staring eye, fixed outward towards those who looked on the puzzle. While the viewer's eyes were flicking back and forth across the image, across duck and rabbit. It was watching them. Unblinking. It was on the cold winter day of my son's funeral that I rediscovered the book. I found it in his room, hidden under the bed, even more worn and yellowing than ever. As I picked it up, not recognising it at first, it fell open on the image of the duck rabbit. I looked back and forth across the page. First the duck, then the rabbit, the crooked beak and the shy nose, the anger and the fear and the anger and the fear over and over, and nothing in between but that empty, full, staring eye. I found myself unable to look away, fixed with the strange feeling that the duck rabbit was the one watching me, trying to figure out a solution to this fractured puzzle.
That was a great story, very chilling.
Yeah,
yeah, really. Yeah, amazing. Okay, this next story is by Heather Jeffrey and it's called One Rabbit Less. The cocker spaniel, Pugsley, was 2 years old when the Rhodesian Ridgeback came to live with him. He was used to having an independent life, travelling first class in the car, snoring on the grand sofas and sitting up to the dining table waiting to be served. He was the most contented of this contented breed. That is, until Kailini Ice Queen arrived. Her regal name demanded a suitable diminutive, and Sisi was chosen because when the letters are reversed, it becomes the Egyptian goddess Isis. What better name for a hound? Pugsley was not impressed. He was put out, seeing that this grotesque puppy was really only a cur. A cur that would become 3 times the size of him, take up 3 times the space of a sofa, eat 3 times the amount of food, and far worse than all of that, take up some of his quality time. Pugsley was finicky about food, but now he refused to eat at all by way of protest. He was pleased to see that this resulted in special attention, but was miffed that Cece, who was a lonely pup, doted on him. Revolting! She treated him as she had her siblings back home and followed them everywhere, laying down as close as possible, her baby brown eyes turned creepily in his direction. His lack of enthusiasm festered dryly until that game-changing day, when Cece ate all her own food, licked her chops, and then polished off the remainder of his. Action had to be taken. He gained an appetite, ate everything offered to him, quick as a flash. He hovered near Cece's bowl and case with youthful mind, wondering she should get distracted from her food and he could have a quick gobble. He overlooked nothing. But not only did Cece adore him, she wanted to be just like him in everything. So, she began to wipe her own plate so clean with her long, rasping tongue that not a speck could be found, not even the smell of food. Coupled with this discovery, Pugsley noticed certain other changes were taking place. Cece had continued to grow and was now towering over the little tyke on four long legs. The hair along her spine, which grew the wrong way, formed a ridge like a dagger, the hilt shifting between her shoulder blades, the long, slender knife stretching out along her back, a promise of death drawn along her spine like a warning to the feckless prey. This was a killing machine. Slowly and surely, Pugsley began to hatch his plans. On one of their long walks in the station, the canines were let off their lead at the usual point, just over the bridge. They both promptly disappeared into the woodland, and then, unexpectedly, Pugsley nosed out a rabbit and chased it down on the railway line. Next thing, Cece could be seen down the track chasing the squeaking rabbit. She was unlikely to notice that a little thing like a freight train hurtling noisily towards her. Pugsley stood watching. "Oh, shit! Pugsley! Cece! Come here!" Calling their names at the edge of panic achieved nothing, and using hand signals when they were not looking was not too bright either. So it seemed a motherly instinct when Cece nudged Pugsley back up onto the path and he was quickly put back onto his lead. But the hand reaching for the ridgeback came away empty as the mutt glided mistily back upon the track with Pugsley straining to watch the sideshow. The rabbit, out of its wits, doomed to die, ran squeaking this way and that. Its limbs continued exerting themselves until she, galumping after with gleeful exuberance, caught the rabbit. Eek! She bit it through the throat and threw it about violently, then darted halfway up the grass slope into the thick of the trees, stood still and silent. Pugsley, thwarted, tried to chase her back down, but was held firmly by the lead. Cece waited, the rabbit limp in her mouth, legs still working feebly. Then she flipped it around like a pelican might until the crown, with its bunny ears, was in her chops. She ate it, wolfishly, head first with a crunch, right down to the bowels. Pugsley could not get near her. She kept close, but just out of reach. He watched while the whelp thought, now, here is a good place to hide the leftovers. But Pugsley would never find it. Far from the path where the other dogs tread, some are safe. A private larder. Very pleased and thinking himself very clever to hide it in a field, she ran blithely onto a bridge to be fussed over and put back on the lead. Exactly at that moment, a train thundered along the track. Pugsley could not believe his bad luck for Cece was alerted to the absolute truth. She could have been on that track when that monster appeared. She had learned from her experience and would never go down there ever again. When they returned to that same spot the following day, Pugsley observed her as she jerked her head out of the loose collar and ran into the field utterly convinced that she would find her booty, and then bobbed up and down for several minutes looking, refusing to believe that some other animal had polished it off. Pugsley now knew her weakness for a fact. She was stupid. Pugsley fervently hoped that Cece would one day leave and go back to wherever she had come from. Sissy, on the other hand, craved nothing more than to curl up as Pugsley in his basket, on the sofa, under the table, wherever he tried to hide to be free of his persistent pest. Then one day, they would be seen in the small basket together. Pugsley was squashed beneath a bulk, and though apparently sleeping, he had one eye open. He had a new plan. If Sissy was on the floor, Pugsley was on the sofa. If Sissy was on the sofa, Pugsley was on the plump cushion. If Sissy had a head on a cushion, Pugsley was on the windowsill. Sissy was a clumsy dog, and there would be an accident involving a rather large animal of the canine variety falling between the sofa and the windowsill and breaking her neck instantly. Pugsley shut his single eye with contentment.
And that was wonderful. That was One Rabbit Less by Heather Jeffrey.
Thank you very much, Heather.
And this last story, very special to us. The writer of this story is 10 years old, and his name's Josh Nevin. Thank you very much for writing this for us, Josh. I believe it's untitled. Josh Nevin. One day, in a land far, far away, not really, it's only Lambeth, there was a man called Adam. Adam the Demolition Man. Adam lived in Elephant and Castle, and to be precise, Elephant and Castle was a busy place, so you could imagine how hard it was for Adam when he was going to blow up two derelict abandoned flats. Adam had recently ordered 25 tonnes of dynamite. He was going to place the explosives in those flats I just told you about. 2 days later, nothing happened except for a couple of vandals spraying graffiti over those derelict flats. Did I mention that those flats were dangerous? The day after that, though, Adam had set up all the dynamite and he was ready to go. He just needed to set up the trigger using a timer that had a time that you could set yourself. He had set the trigger. Well, he would have if the Lambeth Council hadn't stopped him. "Stop in the name of Lambeth Council," said the Lambeth Council, which, like most other councils, were rather rubbish. The Lambeth Council did not approve of people doing this. See, I told you they were rubbish. "You can't tell me what to do. The demolition companies let me do this. Anyway, you guys are as rubbish as an old plastic bag," complained Adam.
"We don't care how bad we are. We just want to get more money. So by putting up the tax rate, we'll get more money. And the more money we get, the more teddy bears we can buy."
Adam gaped. "You buy teddy bears?"
"Yep,"
said the Lambeth Council. There were a few silent moments. Then Adam burst into laughter. "You spend all that money on worthless teddy bears. I mean, seriously, all that just for a teddy bear or two." The Lambeth Council weren't listening. In fact, they'd actually walked off. They just didn't understand why he was laughing so much. Meanwhile, Adam had silenced. In fact, he was just about to set off the trigger when the Lambeth Council came again. Okay, they didn't actually come this time, which meant that he could set the trigger. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And the flats were toppling down like crazy. Not a single creature could survive the life-crushing fall of these buildings. Everything went well until one of the blocks collapsed onto another building, badly damaging it. "Oh, cripes," said Adam, and he ran off. But who knows where he is today? Thank you very much.
Yeah, that's great.
That was Untitled by Joshua Nevin.
Joshua, maybe you can get in touch with us and give it a title.
Yeah, thank you. Just got a few announcements before you go. Hope you have very nice, sweet dreams after that. We've got a couple
Thank you to all the writers, by the way.
Yes, thank you very much to everyone. We've got a couple of I Think Comfortably's coming up. One is on Thursday, the 7th of November, and it's in the wonderful Lopping Hall, which is in Loughton in Essex. And the theme of that one is forest, and the deadline for the stories is the 31st of October. And the next one is quite a special one for us. They're all special, but this one's especially special because it's our 5th birthday celebration, and it's at Arts Admin on the 22nd of November. The theme is birthday, of course, and the deadline for that will be 7 days before, 15th of November. So the theme's birthday. We really hope that all of our regular people can come to that. It's going to be very special.
It's going to be very nice.
We've got jelly and ice cream. We're going to play Murder in the Dark. We've got party hats and everything. Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
So do come. And meantime, thank you very much once again to all of the writers for Sitting Comfortably Animals, both the live show and the podcast.
Yeah.
We're continually honoured and humbled by the quality of the submissions. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Have a good night.
Sweet dreams.
Sweet dreams. Very nice.